Okay, welcome everybody. we have another full day of practice together to begin with some Dhamma reflections. I was thinking I would address, there was a couple of questions about, actually a few, about mindfulness of breathing. So I thought I would pick up that theme of mindfulness of breathing for people to pursue. Mindfulness of breathing is probably the most common meditation in the Buddhist tradition, and certainly in the discourses, the Buddha's instructions, that's probably the most common meditation that the Buddha himself taught, and even one would assume that he actually practiced himself. There was an occasion where the Buddha went on an extended period of retreat, just in his dwelling place in the Jeta Grove in Savatthi, and Ananda, as his attendant, would come and bring food, look after his needs. And one day, the Buddha asked Ananda, "What would you tell people if they asked you what is the Buddha doing? What meditation is the Buddha dwelling in? How would you answer?" And of course Ananda said, "Well, I'm not sure. How should I answer that?" And the Buddha said, "Well, you can tell people that the Tathagata dwells in mindfulness of breathing, and so doing anapanasati." And it's a meditation that one can take with one wherever one goes. You have to breathe, and so it's always there for you. It's always present. So it's something that can be tuned into. Remember one time Ajahn Chah being asked by a lay person what to do, because it's just seems so difficult to practice in the world, and looking after livelihood, looking after family, looking after various social relationships. It just seems that I don't have enough time to meditate. And Ajahn Chah asked him, "Do you have enough time to breathe?" And of course, he said, "Well, yeah, I can." Said, "Then you've got enough time to meditate. I mean, you've got your meditation is your breath, and part of it is the breath is always there, so one can be directing attention to that. But also, when one sees the importance of meditation or mental cultivation, development our spiritual development as important as breathing, then we'll make time. Because it's really true. It is just such a it's critical to our well-being and our existence. So that that sense of a food. One of the idioms that Ajahn Chah used was food for the heart. We're providing sustenance and nourishment for our hearts. So the mindfulness of breathing is a big part of that. And it's something that we say, the traditional or classical sutta presentation of mindfulness of breathing is the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing that are found in the teaching on mindfulness of breathing. There are several discourses where the Buddha talks about it, and actually it is something that we hear at Abhayagiri and many monasteries chant on a regular basis. So it's familiar to us. We chant it, we recollect it, and it comes to mind pretty consistently. And I saw that the chanting books that you're using for this retreat are the Amaravati chanting books, and they're easily downloadable, and there's two volumes. The first volume has many chants, and the teaching on mindfulness of breathing is on page 85. So that can be your homework after the retreat. Working with that. And the Buddha is, it's actually quite a very straightforward discourse. And bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. This is I'm skipping the Pali as well. So, but that's in the chant, the Pali is there, English is there. But this development of mindfulness of breathing is following the structure of the four foundations of mindfulness. And four foundations of mindfulness are a very central part of the tools that the Buddha has given. And when the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. And those seven aspects of training the mind that lead to awakening, enlightenment. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. The Buddha is giving a lot of putting a lot of weight behind this. This is something that is important. Developing the tools, but then also the fruits ripening in true knowledge and freedom. And how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu, gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, having crossed her legs, sets his body erect, having established mindfulness in front of him. So let's say just going to a quiet place, which can be, it can be anywhere. Key, it can be in your home, in your apartment, in a park, in at your meditation center, of course, with at your local monastery, of course, the with COVID, there's a lot of distancing and separation, but so we still have our homes, still have our places. And so then this sense of sitting and comfortably, however, can be a chair, can be sitting down, crossing one's legs, or however one sits, so that it is comfortable, but that setting the body erect, a lot of that is just not slumping and collapsing in on oneself. When the body is upright, the mind is more upright. Having established mindfulness in front of him. And of course, all these, because this discourse was given to the monks, and the genders are in the male gender, but it's, these are practitioners, whoever, male, female, or whatever spectrum. But that sense of, oh, having established mindfulness in front, this sense of, and it can be wherever it feels comfortable. Tip of the nose, around the area of the throat, the chest, the abdomen, just somewhere where it is comfortable, and is somewhat say recognizable, and then ever mindful, breathes in, mindful breathes out, and then it goes into the, this is the begin, this is now the beginning of the so establishing mindfulness with the rhythm of the breath wherever, however one is experiencing it. Now this begins the actual so the 16 steps, and the first is the breathing, and then it's divided according to the four foundations of mindfulness, so that four, this we call four tetrads, so that four in the section on the body, four in the section on feeling, four in the section on mind, four on the section of the mind objects or phenomena, dhammas. So I'm breathing in long, one knows, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one knows, I breathe out long. So that's the first step, the long breath. Coming in, going out. And that verb that is saying knows or knowing, knowing, I breathe in, one knows, I breathe in long, one knows, I breathe out long. The verb is pachanati, So it's like a clear knowing. And Pajanati is the verb. When it goes to the noun form, the word is panya. So panya is in wisdom or discernment. So knowing clearly. And then breathing in short, one knows, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one knows, I breathe out short. So this is the first two steps. Long breath, short breath. There's no need to be controlling the breath. It's just a matter of knowing what the breath is. There's no no right or wrong way to breathe, and sort of like, oh, you got too many long breaths in there. You're doing it all wrong. You should have a few short ones just for. It's not the case at all. It's whatever whatever the body is comfortable with, whatever the body is feeling attuned to, and this is just being able to settle into the rhythm of the breath, and then knowing clearly when one is breathing in long, when one is breathing in short, whatever. And it can, however it is, sometimes you take a long in-breath and then it's just this, just a bit of, it's a short out-breath. It's just however the body's responding. So that in that, and the how do you say, the most important thing is the knowing. The next step in the section on the body is and now for all the rest of the 14 stages, the verb changes in terms of the duty or the approach. The verb changes, and say those first two steps were Pajanati, knowing. All the rest of this, the operative verb is Sikkhati, which means training thus, training, learning, educating oneself. I mean, there's some Thai speakers who are here, and it's the word Sikha is the Pali. The word in Thai for study in Sanskrit is Suksa, and the Thais just use that for, that's study, like to be a student is to, that's what you do as a student, is siksa. So that we're learning, we're training, and that's how we learn, is through this training. So we're studying our experiences as we breathe in and as we breathe out. Then, so this is still in the framework of the, in the section on the body, training thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body. Training thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body. And so this taking the whole body as a foundation for this aspect, what we're learning from, what we're studying, what we're training, And so that how do I inhabit my body? Because it's I think it was yesterday I mentioned that James Joyce quote of Mr. Duffy living a short distance from his body. That's a very common experience for people who are living in busy societies, gone through years, if not decades, of formal education and livelihood, and it takes emphasis up into the head, and so that the whole body is sometimes forgotten or miss out on the. In America, it's very interesting, and apparently, I don't know. I haven't been to Europe for a while, but apparently, in America, and it certainly is the case. But like a pedestrian crosswalks, when you have the stick figure that turns green and is like go and sort of walk, that figure is bent over, their head is just sort of out there, and they're going, and that's kind of what it's like certainly for most people. I have heard that Europe is, they're a little bit more upright and sort of body centered, but certainly in North America, then that head's really going out there and leading the way. So the whole body, how do we inhabit this whole body? How do we just not get so caught up in our heads that we forget that there's something below the neck down there, something, and that's it's not an uncommon experience. So just that experiencing the whole body, learning how to take awareness, and experiencing is the word that is used, is the verb that is used for that is patisangweti. And how Ajahn Jeff translates it as sensitive to, which is a nice translation, experiencing, good translation, because the root of it is veti. It's the last. And then pati and sang are both amplifiers. So that, say, like, and veti is the same root as vedana in feeling. So that feeling, sensitive to, or feeling fully. So feeling fully, the whole body. Sensitive to, experiencing, present for the whole body, breathing in, present to, sensitive to, as I breathe out. So that's a helpful anchor for our practice, grounding our practice in the bodily experience. Our minds are, can be all over the place, but just because it's corporeal, it's physical, it's material, so it has some gravity to it, holding it down. I mean, our minds can flit all over the place, but our just gravity helps to hold us here. And that's helpful. So that sensitive to bringing our experience into the body as we breathe in, as we breathe out. The last step in the section on the body is, say, training. Thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formations. I shall breathe out, training thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formations. Ajahn Jeff translates it as calming, which I actually prefer. I mean, I'm just reading from our chanting book. That sense of pasambayang, it's in the same as in the same word as the in the enlightenment factors of pasati, tranquilizing tranquility, but the calming, it has a say, a mental physical element, so settling, calming, making tranquil. So it's and the bodily formations are, I mean, it's just slightly different than what the say when the whole body is sambhagaya, so whole body, and the bodily formations are gaya sankhara. And in the discourses, when the Buddha said the bodily formation, the body conditioners, that is the in and out breathing, so that the one is calming the body and using the breath as a way of calming the body, so that one is settling, calming, making tranquil the whole bodily processes, and of course that's the body itself. So that is a something that one is using the body as a vehicle for settling, for calming, for making tranquil, and that it's an exercise, training, that sikkhati, you know, one's training with this. And when we train and we're learning, I mean, sometimes, you know, I mean, it's just the same as any other kind of training or learning. You know, sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not. But it's in the doing that we learn. And then sometimes, when we're training, you know, sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's difficult. But it's we keep coming back to the training, working with the breath, working with the body, and working with this whole, say, anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing. But as we do it, we do keep learning. Well, what works? What doesn't work? What's helpful? What's not helpful? What feels really supportive, and what seems to be a bit of a dead end? And then sometimes, you know, in the same way, when we are doing learning something or training in something, some things which feel completely hopeless and difficult, after a while, that becomes easy. It's just the nature of training. It's the nature of learning. It's the nature of doing. So that with mindfulness of breathing, it is not that the say one sits down and then pays attention to the breath, and then everything becomes completely clear. This is an ongoing, ongoing learning, ongoing training. The next section, the next tetrad, is the tetrad on feeling, on the Vedana section, if one lines it up with the four foundations of mindfulness. And the so piti pati sangveti, and so training thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. Training thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. So the word is piti, and again this word experiencing or sensitive to, feeling fully. So that once there's the body's more relaxed, there's a settling, and one can start tuning into the pleasant feelings that arise. And rapture's maybe a bit strong, there's other words that joy, exhilaration, as the mind is, say, settling on the breath, is becoming more steady, the body is relaxing, it's becoming more tranquil and easeful. Internally, the feeling that arises within the mind is one of it's kind of exhilarating, light, joyful, and that's to be attended to. It's to be to be encouraged to be open to that kind of well-being. In the same way that, say, training thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. Training thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. The Pali word is sukha. So that piti, joy, tends to be a bit more, say, mind-oriented, a bit more of a mental event. The sukha, happiness, pleasure, that's a bit more within the body, a bit more of a bodily experience, and satisfying, or always just feeling pleasant, pleasurable. Sometimes, and for some people, the meditation doesn't seem very pleasurable. Why would you make yourself sit there and do nothing? I mean, good grief. But the opportunity to settle and still and kind of deeply relax or make tranquil this whole body-mind process, is very conducive to joy and pleasure. There's very happy states of mind. And the next step in the section on feeling is training thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formations. Training thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formations. This is citta sankhara. So mental formations, citta, of course, being mind, or the mind formations, mental formations. And sankhara is both formations, but it's also that which forms. So that they say sometimes like the mental or the mind conditioners. So what conditions the mind? And this is why it's in this section on feeling, because what forms the mind, constructs the mind, no, it's a mental constructions, mental formations, what forms it, what constructs it, what conditions it, is what the Buddha points to is feeling and perception. Those are in terms of like our the five khandhas, the aggregates of being, those the aspects of the mind, they're fundamental to the mind. Every mental state has a feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and has sanya. It has a perception, memory, association. This, because that's what this is a kind of a pre-thought process. This is not thinking. It's our perceiving, recognizing, associating, and then the feeling tone that we experience around that. So that's what, say, starts the ball rolling in the in the mind. So in order to understand the mind, we've got to understand its fundamental processes, its root processes. So this experiencing sensitive to, being sensitive to, being able to feel fully these mental formations. This is feeling and perception, feeling and memory, feeling and association, seeing what is going. So it's like a deeper level of the mind. And because that's where the mind starts to move out from that point. And sometimes once it starts moving out, then it's like the train's left the station and you're left behind. That's a problem. So getting to know that. And then also the last step in this section on feeling is training us. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formations. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formations, or calming the mental formations. So the same mental form, one attends to that sense of calming, settling, making tranquil. Of course, it has to be done in full awareness, full recognition, so that one is... because the more clearly one sees or recognizes or experiences, then one is inclined to settle and calm rather than getting on the proliferation train, and that it's deeply settling, so that we're, and it's, but it's very fundamental processes. I mean, first section of the mindfulness of breathing is paying attention to the body. The next thing, just paying attention to feeling. How do we feel? What is the tone? And it's not sort of on the emotional level. It's just the basic feeling tone. pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So then it goes into the next section, which is the section on mind, the citta. And again, this same verb, patisangveti, experiencing, sensitive to. So training thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. Training thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. So this is more like the mood of the mind, the content of the mind. And when, say, looking back at the, or referring back, or thinking back to the Buddha's discourse on and his teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness, when he talks about mindfulness of the mind, it's just knowing the mind with greed as the mind with greed. Knowing the mind without greed as a mind without greed. It's sort of like the content, the mood. Mind with anger as a mind with anger. This is a mind with anger. It's not sort of getting a commentary, go, oh, my mind with anger. It's not, this is what a mind with anger, this is what it's like. That's what the experience is. Without anger, with delusion, without delusion. The contracted mind as a contracted mind, expanded mind as expanded mind. The settled mind as a settled mind. The mind that's still entangled as an entangled mind. The mind that's released as a mind that's released. So this is knowing kind of the fundamental mood of the mind, state of the mind, and its basic kind of content. That's the first step in using that. But once all through this whole cultivation, one is relying on the breath. That's the thread that comes through all of this training or all of this teaching, is the recognition, mindfulness of the in-breath, mindfulness of the out-breath. And that's a very settling, integrating quality that supports our exploration and our development and our learning and our training. So the next one is, say, training thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. Training thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. And gladdening, the word is abhipamodayang, and it can be like pamojas, like delight. Ajahn Jeff translates it as satisfying the mind. So it's like with gladness, with delight, with well-being. And I think it's really helpful to see that this cultivation of, say, mindfulness of breathing and our whole practice is integral to the whole practice, is the incorporating of joy, of pleasure, of gladdening. It's not illegal to feel good and meditate, or meditate and feel good. I mean, it's really important to be able to, because it's such an integral part of the whole unfolding process of the Dhamma, because we can let go, we can relinquish, we can release much more readily from a place of well-being, rather than if we're closed, a feeling put upon, feeling oppressed, feeling closed in. That's not conducive to this path of practice. It's like that aspect of letting go or release is really such an integral part of the whole training and cultivation and practice. It's like Ajahn Chah's very well-known saying: if you let go a little, you'll get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll get a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll get complete peace. And that's what I'd say. It's that letting go is this ongoing unfolding. So this sense of gladdening the mind is important. We can direct attention to themes or thoughts or perceptions that facilitate this sense of gladdening, that sense of satisfying the mind. That's part of the practice or training. The next one is samadhang jittang. Training thus, I shall breathe in, concentrating the mind. So the word samadhi is there, concentrating the mind. Training thus, I shall breathe out, concentrating the mind. I'm not so keen on the word concentrating. People tend to, as soon as you try to concentrate your mind, you tend to get really tense. But maybe settling the mind, you're making the mind stable, making the mind firm, firming up the mind, I breathe in, firming up the mind, I breathe in. But that sense of settling, calming, making firm, firmly establishing, that's for our, it's for our growth and well-being. The next one is a training. Thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. Training. Thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. That vimochayang, liberating, releasing. And this doesn't necessarily mean complete and final liberation or release. This is being willing to even release a little bit. I mean, we're usually so, go, what'll happen if I give up my divine? So just being willing to release our habits, release our attachments, release our identity, identification with things. That's another avenue to sort of pleasurable, and it's very satisfying. So these are all, an important to sort of say, I'm just thinking of it now, this is not a 1-16 program. This is a 16 step that you can pick up at any point, at whatever access point one wants or needs, or however many you find useful. It's a mix and match. It's all there for us to develop as completely as we want in whatever way we do. But it's also you don't want to overwhelm yourself, but it's the Buddha has given us this incredible smorgasbord of great kind of tools and a great array of tools to be able to choose from and work with. So that releasing the mind, and that's that wraps up the section on the mind. The last section is the section on dhammas, dhammanupassana satipatthana. It aligns with that last section on, the mental objects or phenomena or themes of dhamma. And so the very first training, thus I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence. Anicca-anuppassī, training thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence or contemplating inconstancy, as how Ajahn Jeff translated it, as Ajahn Chah translates or expresses quite often, say, uncertainty. Training thus, I shall breathe in, breathe out, contemplating uncertainty or change or impermanence, inconstancy. It's just that the manifestation of anicca, so that's a universal characteristic. This is a doorway into insight, that contemplation of change and lack of permanence in everything, internal, external, coarse or refined, far or near, everything, body, mind, personal world, it's all anicca, it's all impermanent, it's all uncertain, it's all inconstant. And the next is training thus, I shall breathe in contemplating the fading away of passions, viraga, this dispassion, fading away. Training thus, I shall breathe out contemplating fading away of passions. And let's say that directing attention to the cooling and releasing of the desire mode, the grasping mode, the passions that, we get fired up to get this or be that or want that, and you reflect on it as, has it ever really satisfied? Has it ever really fulfilled everything? And you say, that's where this dispassion. It's not aversion, it's not rejection, it's just fading. The passions are fading because it's not actually satisfying. And bringing the mind or the heart to a place of joy and tranquility delight. I mean, that's satisfying. But following desires, going out to the world, or following the desire of self, propping up self in all its various ways, it's worthy of letting it fade, letting it to return to a cooling of dispassion. Training thus, I shall breathe in contemplating cessation. The word is Nirodha. Training thus, I shall breathe out contemplating cessation. Contemplating the ending of things. You know, the mind is attracted to beginnings. We can get really excited about new things, okay, and even just on a really microcosmic level, just with mindfulness of breathing, it's like, why is the in-breath more interesting than the out-breath? Why does attention tend to fade or get distracted on the out-breath? It's kind of how it works. Because we tend to turn away from cessation or ending. That word nirodha or cessation is also, because sometimes it's a synonym for, like dukkha nirodha, the ending of suffering. Ending of suffering can be almost like a synonym for nibbana. But it's also, in terms of a word, ceasing is it has this kind of almost a nihilistic feeling to it, but it's a like the say the ceasing of or bringing about the ending of say of defilements or of delusion, say the greed, hatred, delusion, the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's something that is, but it's also like, or of ignorance. You can paticca samuppada, the whole, all the links are there's your coming into be phase, but then there's also the ending phase, the cessation phase. But that word nirodha, I mean, it does mean cessation, but it has a kind of a spectrum of meaning or nuance, so that a really valid translation is also non-arising. So, like with the say in the dependent origination things, rather than sort of with because usually there's the say like with the arising of feeling and contact, feeling, desire. And then there's also this, cessation of contact, cessation of feeling, cessation of desire. But it's more like with the non-arising of this, or the non-arising of ignorance, there is the non-arising of mental formations. With the non-arising of desire, there's the non-arising of clinging. And that's a really, it's a very important distinction, because we get obsessed with stamping out our greed, hatred, delusion, sort of stamping out our ignorance and lack of knowledge. But it's more like that, this non-arising that we can be attuning to, that's very settling, and then there's a real there's a peace there. So that's the cessation of sort of the non-arising of dukkha.
Yeah.
So we don't have to be like stamping out dukkha. It's more like paying attention in a way that there's a non-arising of dukkha. Complication. The last, just looked at the clock. This I've been going on. the last step in the whole Anapanasati Sutta is training thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. Training thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. And relinquishment in this sense, this patinisika, and there's another word that's quite similar, wosaka, same meaning, relinquishment, but it's always relinquishment of self, a relinquishment of self-identity, relinquishment of that identification with the I, me, and mine kind of program that kind of takes over. And it's that relinquishment or releasing of that of self. It's not, and you don't it's the relinquishment is the relinquishing of a misapprehension, misperception, misunderstanding, as opposed to relinquishing of some kind of solid I, me, and mine, or some sort of solid self. Because that is the whole point of that non-self teaching of the Buddhas is not like in the different formulations of clinging, upadana, Buddha said, attavad upadana, so the attachment, and oftentimes it's translated as attachment to self, but it's attavad upadana, which means like attachment to the belief in self, attachment to the assumption of self, because we assume it into existence. It doesn't, there's no solid self there. It's seeing all the things we assume as self are actually not. So that's why they like with that anatta teaching, that is a middle way teaching that gives us an opportunity to not get caught in the extremes of either negation or affirmation. So in the Pali, you've got atta, which is self, so it's like affirmation, propping it up. And then the nitlata is a negation of self, a negation, a pushing away of self, or a rejection of self. And anatta is a recognition of whatever it is, it's not self. Whatever we assume in terms of body, mind, form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, all the things that we take to be self, it's not. It's just that is that not self teaching of the Buddha. He's pointing to because we can, it's through understanding, through mindfulness, through awareness, through clarity, that we can turn to relinquishment and find that is where our satisfaction lies. That's where our peace lies. That's where our well-being and clarity lies, and in the relinquishment itself. So it's a mindfulness of breathing is giving us a tangible approach to something that is can easily tend to be perceived as just some kind of philosophical doctrine or some belief, some religious belief. Especially this whole teaching on mindfulness of breathing, these are tools that we can use to give us the opportunity to approach and experience the path and its fruits. So I'll offer that for reflection today.
Andamayang dhamma kathaya sadhu garam dhammase sadhu 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 anumodami.
Okay, so it's time for questions and answers. I kind of rambled on for pretty long, but it seemed useful. I might have fewer questions that I can deal with. And there's a lot of questions too, so I'm only going to be able to get to some of them and have to apologize to the rest of you who very wonderfully submitted questions. So one question. Exercise for lay people to overcome laziness, please. I think the aspects of bringing to mind teachings, teachers, the anusati, these recollections of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, of Sangha, so that the, say, the example of the Buddha, or the kind of the presence of the Buddha, these are themes that sort of inspire, or of the teachings that sort of resonate with one, that give one a sense of confidence, or give one a sense of uplift. That's a great way of say overcoming laziness. that recollection of the say practitioners that are have practiced. When we look at the biographies of different practitioners, when you look at say the biographies of teachers who have had some sort of realization, so you realize, well, yeah, they didn't. That didn't come about. Their transformation didn't come about through laziness and waiting for it to happen. It required some effort. So that does Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Also, it helps to. And of course, this is a time of pandemic, so sometimes it's hard to physically get together. But you know, people are really. I mean, just this retreat is. I think it's over 300 people, so that's quite a group gathering. And I'm sure that in different places, there's lots of little groups that are meeting online in different ways. And that's a great way to encourage each other. For me, it's like, it's really one of the benefits of living in a community, living in Sangha, living in a monastery, it's pretty rare that we're all completely lazy and unmotivated at the same time. I mean, there's always somebody who's wow, okay. We might be feeling, oh, okay. But then you see other people practice. Okay. I gotta get my game up again. Yeah. So it's that seeing others that is really. Really helpful, and it's support from others. So, having community, having, as I said, these days, I mean, it's one of the great blessings of the pandemic is people are learning all sorts of new tools for reaching out and connecting with each other in online formats. Okay. Okay, this one, I noticed there is a constant sense of confusion underneath most of the experiences. Other defilements come and go. But moha of various form and intensity seems to be always present. Does Lumpa have any suggestions on working with moha in addition to being aware of it? What counters moha? So, because moha is, excuse me, delusion, not knowing, not seeing clearly. And I mean, it's a root, a defilement, lobha, dosa, moha, greed, hatred, delusion. So it's a, and the Buddha himself pointed to moha as the, the most, say, destructive and difficult, because the deluded mind will justify just about anything. But one of the, say, ways that I found most helpful in dealing with delusions and is, of course, the counterpoint to, say, moha, delusion, is knowing, is awareness, is mindfulness. And so that the more we can establish mindfulness, awareness, clarity of mind, then moha doesn't have traction. It counters it. I mean, there tends to be a problem if you're just like trying to be aware of moha is it's a good way to get entangled or caught, because it's, the mind is, it's like Ajahn Chah says, it's like, the mind is a liar and a cheat. I mean, it's just, that's what it does. So we have to be wary of the mind. And so mindfulness of the body is to me, is a really, really helpful, really effective way of, because then you've got something tangible to build or hang that mindfulness around. Excuse me. And when we have, say, the body as a, in all sorts of different ways, whether it's just the feeling of the body, the feeling of the breath, postures, movement, kind of an embodied awareness, then it, there's a continuity of mindfulness and clarity, so that counters the moha states. It shines light on moha. We can see it much better rather than, oh, I'm going to investigate moha. That's usually a good way to get really to be a good servant to moha. Actually, usually, what happens. So it's you have to come at it kind of from the side in order to see it. So the body is a really good foundation. There's a question asking, please talk about the difference between letting go and nihilism. in this pandemic, sometimes it's hard to discern between letting go and just not caring about things. Thank you. And well, I think there's a very different feeling tone to letting go and nihilism. You know, a true letting go, it's like if you let go a little, you get a little peace. So that letting go is the feeling is one of peace, is one of ease, is one of well-being. That's your, say, your natural result of letting go from the, say, that the Buddhist perspective of when we, say, when we let go, when we release, when we relinquish, there is an experience of a peace of well-being. And the experience of nihilism, of negation, of just don't like it, don't want to deal with it, that's a very different feeling. I mean, it's unpleasant, it's uncomfortable. The mind is not happy, it's not bright. So being able to pay attention to the mood, the feeling tone, the result of what we can label letting go, but the feeling is actually telling you what it is. And so because you know, we can be pretty clever sometimes in couching our defilements with Dhamma explanations. I mean, there's a very long tradition of that, dating back to the time of the Buddha. So that's we have to be alert to that. Question. Can you please speak to the difference in beginning metta meditation with self as opposed to beginning with an external object or person? I often feel depleted when directing outwards. During a Dhamma talk last year to Baigiri, you led it in a different way by beginning with this, with the self, and I had an entirely new experience which resonated with me more than the outward focus. Starting with a focus on kindness towards self seemed to create a greater sense of stability and lightness for me. And I think that is a universal experience, and the traditional forms of directing loving kindness, and the traditional instruction for developing loving kindness always starts with oneself. like in the chanting that we do, which is say reflections on universal well-being, say loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, but that development of loving kindness in particular begins with directing attention toward oneself. May I abide in well-being, or may I be happy. Ahang sukhito, may I be happy. May I abide in well-being. and it's various in freedom from affliction, freedom from hostility, freedom from ill will, freedom from anxiety. And may I maintain well-being in myself. That's a traditional form. And then it isn't until then that one starts to direct it out. And in teachers who use the say loving kindness meditations who are accomplished in it, they'll advise to don't even begin even considering directing attention out until you've got a really good solid foundation of that loving kindness kind of steeped within oneself. It's like, yeah, you've got to have a little bit of money in the bank before you can loan it to somebody else or give it to somebody else. I mean, this is a very, very simple kind of equation. And similarly with on the emotional level, one needs to care for oneself, because we can get depleted when we look around the world and our people close to us, near to us, family, friends, society, world in general, it's kind of endless. So we can be, we can make it a very tiring in trying to have care and kindness and loving feelings toward, if we don't have a solid base. And one of the images that I found very helpful with the cultivation of metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, is that it's beginning with, of course, it's an emotion, it's a heart feeling, this sense of the heart softening and opening and expanding with loving kindness and care. And it's like having we begin, it's like a small vessel, a small bowl that we start to fill up. But then as we get a bit more adept, a bit stronger in our cultivation, that bowl, that vessel can get bigger. The feeling in the heart can expand. But it has that container of the heart, or of this vessel, and this is the base, this is the foundation. And then as we expand it, it becomes stable and solid, and we start to think in terms of to include others, rather than it going out to go and deliver your loving kindness parcels around. You're inviting people into that sphere, or that container of loving kindness, and it can get bigger and it can grow and become more encompassing. But the base is always, it's always here in the heart. So that's a way of working with it. Maybe one more question. Greetings to Lumpur. Very grateful for your teaching and guidance. My question is, How does one live in harmony with others who hold different views and have different understanding about things? And how does one live in harmony with oneself when facing challenges? Thank you for your kind teaching. Well, don't argue, don't fight. living with others, there's going to be different views and different understanding. It's quite natural. It's quite ordinary. It's not actually strange that not everybody has the same views and understandings as me. I mean, that's actually normal. So being able to recognize that, it shouldn't be a surprise or a shock. It's our own kind of delusions that are problematic. remember Ajahn Chah saying, there was a big community, lots of different people, different temperaments, different personalities. At any given time, there'd be 60, 70, 80 monks, 60, 70, 80 nuns. When it came to the rains retreat, he would actually bring the numbers down to about 45, send people off to other branch monasteries to get the numbers down again. But it was always very diverse and very different people living together. and he would say, well, just let the forest teach you. You live in the forest, and if you look around in the forest, I mean, there's big trees, there's little trees, there's straight trees, there's crooked trees, there's vines. They all live together in harmony. That's quite natural. You don't see the trees arguing with each other. It's just this nature living together and working around each other and accepting each other. So it's just acknowledging the differences and recognizing them, but not being surprised or shocked in that. And then if there are views and understandings that are quite detrimental and quite negative, then one has to sort of enter into some kind of dialogue or try to develop an understanding. And that takes patience, and it takes a skillfulness to navigate that. And then sometimes, I mean, there's some people who one knows or has have contact. I mean, it's like the very first line of the discourse that the Buddha gives on the highest blessings. Asevana jabalat, to not associate with fools or foolish people, people who are really unskillful. So that, and that doesn't means anybody who disagrees with it, you can dismiss as fools and then use the the Buddha told me to not associate. But it's like, but there is a point where one is, okay, you know, I don't have to do this. This is really tiring, and it isn't fruitful, it isn't productive for me, isn't productive for anybody really. So there is a recognition that you know, there's a gradation of association and amount of engagement that one needs to do, but then a high degree of acceptance and willingness to acknowledge differences. I mean, you can't even have your five fingers on your hand be the same. I mean, you can't even control that. They're different. So that's the nature of human beings in existence. So there's going to be differences, but when it's like, you know, our hands are great tools because, you know, they work. It works together. And so that the same with our relationship with other human beings. It's a skill that has to be developed and learned. Okay, I think that's it for today, or this session.